Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. Thanks for joining us for the docket on December 15th, 2021. Today on the docket, Derek Chauvin now has a federal felony conviction. The Crumblies remain in custody. The streets are so safe in New York for criminals that crime is taking place literally on crowded streets. A man facing execution waives the attorney-client privilege to locate remains of his victims. And our dumb criminal of the day never learned the rule of 8 hours from bottle to throttle. Let's talk about it. Before we get to the docket, a few housekeeping matters to discuss. First, thank you for joining us last night for the Crime Talk After Dark. I hope you all enjoyed the conversation with Mark Carlson, a former police officer and my private investigator, as we discussed his role in a criminal defense case and law and order issues. We'll try to bring more of that to you in the future. Now, if you haven't done so already, please hit that subscribe button, hit that like button, leave me a comment below, and as always, thank you for watching. Okay, let's get to the docket. Derek Chauvin, remember him? The former Minneapolis police officer already convicted of murdering George Floyd has pled guilty to federal charges that he violated the 46-year-old's civil rights when kneeling on his neck for more than 9 minutes during that notorious May of 2020 incident that was captured on video. So in May, Chauvin and three other former police officers involved in Mr. Floyd's death were indicted on federal charges for deprivation of rights while acting as law enforcement officers. The indictment alleged the group violated Floyd's rights to be free from unreasonable seizure and excessive force and failed to provide the unarmed black man medical care even after he cried out for help. Now, the change of plea to the federal charges means Chauvin, who is currently being held at a prison in Oak Park Heights, Minnesota, now faces an additional 25-year sentence that will run concurrently with his current prison sentence. That means basically he's getting a two-for-one deal. Concurrent means run together. As part of the guilty plea, Mr. Chauvin will have to pay restitution for his crimes charge and agreed never to work as a law enforcement officer again, like that was going to happen. He also waived his rights to appeal any sentence that the judge would enter in this particular case. Now, Chauvin is also, because of his plea, no longer facing charges in a second indictment stemming from a 2017 arrest of a 14-year-old boy in which it is alleged that he used a similar neck restraint. Next on the docket, the parents of the accused Michigan high school shooter, Ethan Crumley, who's 15, appeared in court for a probable cause determination. Now, attorneys for the parents agreed to postpone a probable cause hearing, but they vowed to ask the court to reduce the $500,000 cash-only bond for each defendant, and they must pay that before they can actually be released from jail. I don't know about you, but do you have $500,000 laying around if you were having to post that for bail? Most people could not. Well, James Crumley, 45, and Jennifer Crumley, 43, are each charged with four counts of involuntary manslaughter. Now, prosecutors allege that the parents acted grossly negligent and caused the death of the four teens their son is accused of gunning down on November 30th. The two parents were arrested in a building in downtown Detroit after authorities suggested that they were attempting to flee. An attorney for one of the parents said they were scared and were scheduled to turn themselves in. Now, the Crumleys, the parents, on Tuesday again, waived any conflict that might manifest by being represented by attorneys within the same law firm. The attorneys representing the duo, Shannon Smith and Mario Lehman, also certified that no conflict exists. I would have to humbly disagree. These parents should have separate independent counsel, not working in the same firm. Although their interests may seem rather focused and on the same page in this moment, that could absolutely change if new evidence were to come about. And if a conflict is to develop, guess what? Both of the attorneys would more than likely have to get off the case. It just makes sense for the court to step in and say, no, we're not doing this. Everyone needs to get their own defense team and they need to be from separate firms. My humble opinion, I just think it's a conflict. Wouldn't do it. And a lot of judges shouldn't and won't allow it in their courtroom. Now, the defense team has said that they've discussed how to handle this conflict of interest if it should occur down the road, and they're prepared to announce to the court if such conflict arises. Everybody's happy until they lose, and then the first issue they're going to raise on appeal is, I had a ineffective assistance of counsel because there was a conflict. They never should have taken my case. So just be ready for that issue to come about. Now, prosecutors said that the delay of the probable cause hearing contemplated under Michigan law within 21 days of the defendant's arrest is basically a result of the large amount of discovery, and it was described as staggering. In fact, the district attorney rattled off a bunch of reports from her office they were receiving from federal, state, and local agencies, and they said basically the typical protocols for the discovery to be produced would simply not be adequate in this particular situation. The prosecutors noted that the defense joined the request to push the probable cause examination to a future date, and the defense also agreed to a protective order as to the evidence which depicts the shooting and the injuries. A protective order is simply an agreement and an order signed by the court saying you're not going to release this information to any third parties not directly working on this case. So obviously it's attorney, their staff, investigators, or any experts. The material at issue will remain at the prosecutor's office and will be viewable there, but not anywhere else pursuant to the protective order. Now, the prosecutor said the first wave of discovery has been turned over to the defense, but they anticipate a lot more coming that way. Now, Judge Julie Nicholson signed the agreed protective order for the cases against each parent. She also agreed to push the probable cause hearing to February 8th of 2022 at 1:15. Both defendants spoke briefly to the judge by responding in the affirmative that they consented to the delayed probable cause. Now, defense attorney said another motion would be forthcoming regarding the defendant's bond, perhaps as early as this week, depending on the status of the discovery. And as I said earlier, each parent is currently facing a $500,000 cash bail. Judge Nicholson set that motions hearing for January 7th at 1:15 to discuss that motion and any forthcoming motions. Now, for those of you who are not familiar, Ethan Crumley, who will be tried as an adult, faces 24 charges that include one count of terrorism causing death, four counts of first-degree murder, seven counts of assault with intent to murder, and 12 counts of possession of a firearm in the commission of a felony. Now, this is where things get interesting. Now, given the fact that Ethan Crumley will be tried as an adult in the adult system, alleging that he acted under his own autonomy, raises some questions as to whether the decision to bring those charges against his parents could be undermined by the prosecution because of the implied responsibility being placed on the Crumley parents. So the decision to try Ethan Crumley as an adult could have a greater impact on his own parents' case than his. Now, Ethan Crumley, if he's a child who's under the control of his parents, it's less likely that he can independently break that chain from them to these deaths. But by charging him as an adult, the prosecutor is communicating their view that he is an independent actor and that he has the capacity and decision-making capability that an adult will have. So when it comes to making a case for the involuntary manslaughter against the parents, the prosecutor has to prove two things. First, gross negligence and causation. Now, in this case, gross negligence would likely require the prosecution to present proof that the parents did not take the proper care to avert the attack that an ordinary person would have, proving the parents culpable by demonstrating potential disregard to a known hazard, so to speak. Now, to prove causation, prosecutors have to establish that the parents caused the deaths in the attack, and the proof must be established in two ways. First, the prosecutors must establish that the deaths would not have occurred had the parents not conducted themselves in a certain way. Now, if Crumbly used the gun that his parents purchased to carry out the alleged attack, which I think most people believe that is the case, would this be enough? It may not be enough. The second part requires proof that the parents were liable and could be a greater challenge. First, the prosecutors would have to answer whether the attack was something the parents could reasonably foresee actually taking place and given their negligent actions. This is where trying Ethan Crumley as an adult comes into play. because if Ethan Crumley is an adult that acted on his own accord, this breaks the link between the parents and the attack. So it could actually work against him. Now, that's one of the things that we talked about before, and people said, oh my gosh, Scott, you are crazy. You don't know what you're talking about. People said, there's the text message that the mother sent. Now, my understanding is that the parents were called to the school to discuss a situation at school. Apparently, the younger Crumley was seen looking to buy ammunition at school. The parents were called. They also see some drawings that are upsetting to them. I have not seen any information that says the parents knew that the younger Crumley had the firearm at school. There is also no indication, and from what I am aware of, and I'm sure if I'm wrong, somebody will let me know, but the text message that was sent from the mother to the younger Crumley was that was after she heard that there was a report of a shooting at school where she said, don't do it. Not beforehand. Now, obviously, if it was beforehand, the analysis may change. But if it's after the fact that once the shooting takes place, you can't do it. Now, think about it. I know everybody's upset and everyone's saying, Scott, you're being insensitive. These people knew. Okay. First of all, it's not illegal to give a 14-year-old a firearm. It may not be what you want to do, but it's not illegal. And in this particular situation, the family apparently is involved with firearms. And if not this firearm, there would have been another firearm. So think about this example. If you have children and they go out and you think they're going to be driving to the movies with their friends, but instead they take a frolic and they go out and get booze and they drive across town and somebody dies. Are you responsible for that necessarily? Did you think that was reasonably foreseeable? Maybe you should have gotten the car yourself and driven with them so they could not have had the other kids get in or the booze that were purchased, right? At a certain point, the duty as a parent is cut off under the law. I understand the emotional situation. People say, Scott, you're insensitive. No, I'm not. I'm just simply saying what the law is. In fact, let's take a look at what the law says from the Michigan jury instructions. The prosecution has to show, and this is coming straight from the jury instructions, first, that the defendant is charged with the crime of, obviously, involuntary manslaughter, and that you may also consider the lesser charges of involuntary manslaughter. To prove the charge, the prosecution must prove each of the following elements beyond a reasonable doubt. First, that the defendant caused the death of the deceased. That is, that the deceased died as a result of the actions of the parents, right? Third, you have to define gross negligence. We'll do that in a second. And in doing so, the act caused the deceased's death, and the defendant acted in a grossly negligent manner. This act requires the intent to injure, okay? This act requires the intent to injure. So you basically have to show that the parents wanted this shooting to take place. I'm not sure what evidence you're going to have that's going to prove that particular element. Second, in doing so, the act caused the deceased's death. The defendant intended to injure the deceased. And the act charged in this case is obviously the murder. And it says the prosecution must prove the following beyond a reasonable doubt. First, that the defendant committed the crime and that the crime used a force of violent touching of the person or someone closely connected with the person, and that the offensive touching must have been intended by the defendant. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I get it. Everyone thinks, well, you shouldn't have these kids do it, but they have to show that the defendants wanted this to happen. I'm not sure they're going to be able to show that. And then the final element is that the prosecution would have to show that the defendant, remember mom, dad, caused the death without the lawful excuse or justification. Now, let's take a look at the gross negligence instruction. The gross negligence instruction says, gross negligence means more than carelessness. It means a willful disregarding of the results to others that might follow from an act or failure to act. In order to find that the defendant was grossly negligent, you must find each of the following three things beyond a reasonable doubt. First, that the defendant knew of the danger to another. That the defendant knew there was a situation that required the defendant to take the ordinary care to avoid injuring another. Second, that the defendant could have avoided injuring another by using ordinary care. And third, that the defendant failed to use ordinary care to prevent injuring another, when to a reasonable person it must have been apparent that the result was likely to cause serious injury. Once again, you notice the jury instructions, ladies and gentlemen, it's not meant for a parental responsibility type of claim. Maybe civilly, the parents were going to get sued to the nth degree. Criminally, I think this is somewhat of a novel case, and I'm not sure that the prosecution is going to be able to make this. I'm not even sure, even though a judge has found probable cause, that this is going to hold up. And, you know, like I said, if new facts become available, it may make me change my mind. But as of right now, certainly the son needs to be held accountable. We'll give everybody the presumption of innocence. But this seems a bit of a stretch to try and get a case to stick. Before we go on, let's take a brief recess to hear from our sponsors of today's video, CrimeTalkSearch.com. Please go to CrimeTalkSearch.com, sign up for a background subscription service. You'll be happy you did. If there's anyone out there you were ever curious about what was in their background, now is the time to do it. If you're going to get involved with somebody, now is the time to do it. When you go to crimetalksearch.com, you put in the name, literally millions of public records are searched, and a report is generated. And it's going to give you a report. If they have multiple social media accounts, you're going to find it. If they have multiple phone numbers, multiple email addresses, it's going to be found. And more importantly, you're going to get information regarding criminal history. Hopefully the person you're searching has none whatsoever, but if it's there, it's going to be found. You're going to get everything you'd want to know, whether you're going into business or whether you're going into a personal relationship, you're going to be able to find out the information you want to know. So go to crimetalksearch.com, sign up today. You'll be happy you did. All right, we're back. Well, it looks like the crime situation in New York is so good for the criminals, they can do it in broad daylight. Take a look at this video. It shows muggers pummel a delivery worker stealing his scooter in broad daylight. Now, the pair of muggers that pummeled the delivery worker and swiped his electric scooter in a broad daylight attack at a busy Bronx intersection. Now, the footage released by the New York Police Department shows the 46-year-old victim stopped at a red light at 3rd Avenue and East 149th Street in Mott Haven just before 10:30 a.m. on December 7th, when a man pulled up next to him on a bike and another man ran up to him on foot. The second suspect socks him multiple times in the face, knocking him off the scooter and to the ground. This is all you can see it in the footage. The stumbling victim managed to get up, but not before the man who allegedly punched him in the face took off on his scooter. And then the other suspect rode off on the bike, and thank goodness he's okay. But can you imagine being robbed in broad daylight in the middle of an intersection and there's no suspects? I mean, it's just crazy, ladies and gentlemen, crazy. Why? Because people think they can get away from it. This is an interesting case. So a man who was being executed waived his attorney-client privilege so that his attorneys could tell where the remains were, okay? David Neil Cox, who called himself, quote, worthy of death, end quote, ditched his finals appeals and became the first inmate executed in Mississippi in 9 years last month for the killing of his estranged wife and then sexually assaulting his stepdaughter as her mother passed away. Now, David Neil Cox had long been a suspect in his sister-in-law's death and admitted killing the 40-year-old woman prior to his execution, and he waived his attorney-client privilege upon his death. So David Cox, who admitted to killing his sister-in-law just before his execution, also left behind a map for investigators leading to the discovery of the human remains the prosecutor said are likely those of Felicia Cox, who disappeared in 2007. They were ultimately discovered in Pontotoc County using a map drawn by her brother-in-law, David Neil Cox. Now, Felicia Cox disappeared visiting David Neil Cox's strange wife, Kim Kirk Cox, in 2007. Felicia Cox was last seen on July 2, 2007, and her Chevy Blazer was found abandoned. The 50-year-old Cox told his attorneys that he had killed his sister-in-law before he was executed on November 17th for the deaths of his wife going back to 2010. Now, the remains were taken to a medical examiner for an autopsy and a DNA analysis. Felicia Cox's daughter, Amber, and other relatives were present at the discovery site, which was actually on land that once belonged to the woman's family. Investigators used cadaver dogs and ground-penetrating radar, along with the executed man's detailed map, to find the remains. Now, obviously, this is nice for the family to get closure on a missing persons case, and it's essential to the family. And of course, it's also important to law enforcement to get some answers on this case that has gone on for so long. Now, the remains, like I said, were found after 3 hours of digging, and investigators said that Cox is the only person involved or suspected in the death, but authorities have not released any details as to how they believe she was killed or the circumstances leading up to it. Now, this raises a couple of interesting issues, okay? Attorney-client privilege. If Mr. Cox had told his attorneys, here's the map, here's what I did, they could never release that information to anyone because that would be protected by the attorney-client privilege. It required him to waive the attorney-client privilege so that his attorneys could release that information. Otherwise, the attorneys could get disbarred for releasing that information. So, you know, sometimes attorneys know where the bodies are buried and they can't tell anyone. At least this guy, although he probably deserved the death penalty, according to his own words, maybe a little bit of redemption that he gave some closure to the family. All right, next on the docket. An ultralight pilot is our dumb criminal of the day. And he's never heard of the 8 hours from bottle to throttle, which is what they drill into pilots. So Joseph Kroll, 61, was busted a Monday afternoon upon showing signs of alcohol impairment after wrecking his plane at the entrance of the Heather Ridge subdivision in Indiana. Fortunately, no one was hurt, including Mr. Kroll of Mill Creek, who narrowly missed a home and appeared to have smashed into a pole. I mean, take a look at this photo provided by the police. This shows that the aircraft is, in fact, destroyed. Responding officers who found the aircraft that resembled a small single-engine plane said Mr. Kroll failed a field sobriety test at the scene of the wild wreck. Now, after being medically cleared, Mr. Kroll was taken to a hospital where he was submitted to a chemical test and was arrested for operating an airplane while intoxicated and operating it intoxicated. Now, authorities said that he was taken into custody and released on his own recognizance. Now, I've run into various situations like this for pilots over the years. The FAA is going to take Mr. Kroll's license, and he's our dumb criminal just for, well, flying an airplane while intoxicated. That's just dumb, okay? But his only hope is that the district attorney finds the correct statute. Some states don't actually have charges for operating an airplane under the influence. Some do. It has to fit the definition. If not, the remedy is actually potentially in federal court. So Mr. Kroll may be able to have a defense here. It depends on how Indiana's state statute is written or if there's a separate statute for operating an airplane under the influence. All right. I want to thank everybody for watching today. Hope you enjoyed the show. We appreciate you taking the time to do so. We'll see you next time on Crime Talk.